Hey everybody, this is Shane Presley here with Rock Paper Podcast. I want to tell you about my friends over at Music Record Shop. Find them right here in St. Louis, Missouri, in the Grand Center area, in the Dot Zach building. Go over, check it out, come by and visit them. You can go by or visit online, shop 24/7 at musicrecordshop.com. Be sure to follow along with Music Record Shop on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. They're giving away tickets and records and all kinds of fun stuff throughout the day. So get involved, shop local, support local business. They got a lot of cool stuff going on. So you can also reach out if you have a local band you want to get your records on the shelf over there. Reach out and see how you can make that happen. Again, musicrecordshop.com.
Podcast is kind of like a radio show that's not on the radio. It's on the internet. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That's also like my mom. It makes it sound more confusing, doesn't it? It sounds like this.
This is Dana Michael Anderson, and you're listening to Rock Paper Podcast.
Rock Paper Podcast. Rock Paper Podcast. Rock Paper Podcast, y'all.
Hey, everybody. Shane Presley here, Rock Paper Podcast, coming to you from St. Louis, Missouri. Hanging out today at Gaslight with Dana Michael Anderson. Welcome to the show, man.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, this has kind of been a little while in the making. We've become friendly a little bit through Gaslight. Mm-hmm. I've been hanging around here. We ran into each other one day and introduced, and I said, "Hey, man, come on the show." And you said, "Yeah, well, I got a new record coming out soon, and I'd like to do it then." And so today's that day, man. The record's out, ready to roll, and we got a lot going on with the record. We got a big release party and all kinds of stuff happening. But I'm thrilled that this worked out today, that we're here and getting to talk about this new music and getting to know more about what you've been up to and stuff. So thank you for doing this.
Well, it's great to be here.
Yeah,
yeah.
So I know a little bit through you, through JB. I've gotten to become pretty good friends with him over the last couple of years here at Gaslight and stuff, and I know you're a big part of this here too, and everything. But tell me, I guess born and raised in on the other side of the river, right?
Granite City, Illinois. Yeah, born and raised. And as far as my involvement with Gaslight or St. Louis, it's backseat. I'm quiet. Right. Quiet partner. Silent partner, I guess. My investment is more in the real estate and the business. I just give as much advice without becoming involved as I can.
Sure.
Friendly advice. And then I step away from it. So yeah. I find that's the best pattern to make a civil relationship between me and my older brother work. So, yeah.
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 Yeah, it's a very cool thing going on over here, and you recorded this whole record here, is that right?
No. The initial tracks, the drums, bass, my guitar, and my acoustic, my vocal, 10 of the songs were recorded at Sawhorse, and we also got the trombone, trumpet, clarinet, a pedal steel, and some organ recorded there as well. We did Emily Wallace's vocal track here at Gaslight, and then we did some of the other recordings at B&V Studios in Bunker Hill, which is Miles Vanavere and Zeb Briskovich's studio in Bunker Hill, home studio.
Okay.
I think we did the violins, the banjo, the cello, the background vocals, and then the last song, the 11th song on the record, Dreaming It Away, that was recorded there as well. Harmonica, guitar, vocal.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Very cool. I did one over at Sawhorse not too long ago, recording with Jason and Preston over there, and I had a really great time getting to hang with those guys and learning a little more about what they do over there. But it's a beautiful space over there.
Yeah, they're pros. It's fantastic. The rooms are cool. The gear's great. They're great.
Yeah.
It was a great experience, man. Yeah. I enjoyed it.
Very cool. You Well, so while we're talking about the record, so recording there at Sawhorse, and you, like I said, a lot of players on this, a lot of horns, the pedal, or is it a pedal steel slide?
Mm-hmm. Pedal steel, some slide guitar on it, yeah.
A lot of like, but what that kind of what caught my attention when I listened to it was that it was like a lot of variety. I mean, it felt like some of it was a little like, you know, more like country, and then some of it a little more like kind of jazzy, kind of smoky bar lounge kind of thing. I felt vibe, and like you just, and then the horns, and then just a lot of really cool things going on. And I just that's how I love my music too. I love a record that can take all kinds of different directions. You know, you don't get 12 songs that sound the same or whatever it is. It goes on an adventure through each different track of something different. You even had like starts off with Bottles with some like Spanish guitar kind of sounds and
and mariachi trumpet and accordion on the first song. Definitely a Tex-Mex, just, you know, Tijuana dive bar feel for that song. Is this, it kicks off the record like that. So yeah.
Did you have a lot to do a lot of the input on how the different feels of these, or did there some?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It was a little over 2 years ago, and I was spending a lot of time with Zeb Briskovich, and we were hanging out and talking. And one night, he brought up, he was like, "Let's go." You know, I think he was trying to get my mind off of some personal issues that was going on around me, and he was like, "Let's go record a couple songs." And I said, sure, man. I was like, yeah, let's do this. And to get to work with him, you know, I'd been friends with him for a while, but I admire his bass playing, and he's just a sharp guy. And I was excited. I was like, yeah, absolutely. Let's get together and figure something to record out, you know. And I always have a bunch of songs that haven't been recorded, or that have been recorded but not to the level or completed to the level that I would like them to be. And I have a bunch of them laying around all the time.
Right.
So I picked three that I hadn't recorded, and he came over and he saw my songbook, and he's like, "Well, what about this one? And what about this one?" And I was explaining each song to him about what I felt it sounded like. And we literally that evening when we got together to figure out what we were going to record, we ended up with like almost every single song on this record, and we had written down the instrumentation and style for each of the songs. Like, and this was, you know, with no idea if we could even get anybody to play on it. Like, it was just an idea, you know, talking back and forth. So we had it all laid out. Like, I knew Bottles, I wanted it to have a mariachi kind of bar, you know, Tijuana feel. And so we were like, accordion, and, you know, the trumpet, the Ring of Fire, Johnny Cash, you know, that kind of, we knew exactly what we wanted on every song, like, because we had a style for each song, like you said.
Right.
One's a jazz song, one's got Irish influence, one's got we were going for a Graceland record, Paul Simon's Graceland record. We were with Choir in the Sky. We were trying to land on that, you know. So we were like, well, let's pick the instruments that fit those styles. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we did. We sat down and we pretty much nailed it. I think I really wanted a penny whistle on Autumn Bird to push it over the top with the Irish.
Yeah.
And I even like tried contacting him, and Miles, who was the drummer and producer, engineer, mastered it, was like, no, we've got it. He's like, I draw the line at penny whistle. And I was like, okay, fine, that's fine. So I gave him that one. So yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Very cool.
I've been drinking from this bottle, getting on to put it down. Till the night of truth that's fueled by little courage that I found. In the morning I'll be better, at least in other people's eyes. Put my dreams back in the bottle, save them for some other time. So sometimes filled with sorrow. I've been holding it so tight. Said I'll go back to my throne and make everything alright. But the scars round the surface, the only healing now is time. Wish I'd let go of that bottle. Leave these words for me. I've got everything in bottles, arranged so neatly on my shelf. Recommend you check the label before you grab one for yourself. Sometimes it's filled with fury. Just can't wait to make my stand. Things that I'll do to film, just set those visions free. But I look back at that bottle, plain to see it's holding me. And I've got everything in bottles, laying so neatly on my shelf. Recommend you check the label. Now the bottles that they give me, well, they're all just filled with pills. One for every other bottle that I haven't quite yet killed. This is for my pain, up until it's time to leave. But I'm sure it's for their comfort.
So we're talking about bottles available now. You have it on Spotify and iTunes and all the digital platforms.
Yeah, Google Play. I'm not supposed to say this, but you can hear it on YouTube.
Yeah.
Free. The whole record's on there, and you can buy it from me at any of the shows. And if you contact me through Facebook, Dana Michael Anderson, message me. I'll find a way to get it to you personally if you want a hard copy, because the hard copy I think is worth it. The artwork was done by Jim Harper. And I just love the packaging and the font, the art, the whole thing. The whole package came out great. So, yeah, if you want a hard copy, come see a show or contact me, and I'll figure out how to get it to you.
Yeah. So the official, I guess the official release party celebration of the record, you're throwing a party over at Off-Broadway February 2nd.
Yeah. Groundhog's Day.
Yeah. And you're bringing along a bunch of the players you said from the record.
Yeah, so I have the record available now, the hard copies of it. So to do a traditional CD release with this many players and trying to get all of them together on a Friday or Saturday night was like, how far down the road did we have to look to get an open Friday night for, you know, the horn section from the Funky Butt Brass Band or Emily Wallace or, you know, the 10, 15 other musicians that make a living at this on Friday and Saturday nights.
Sure.
So February 2nd is the date we found that works best for the majority of the people that played on the record originally. So I am playing shows between now and then with the CD available, but it's with like a four-piece. Or I just got back from Chicago and did a three-piece. Or solo shows or five-piece. But the full band the closest example of the record is February 2nd at Off-Broadway is going to be the show to go to and see. So that's, we're calling it the CD release. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, man. Listening, I don't know. Obviously, there could be a lot of people, but hearing some of those horns, and like, I immediately thought of Adam. And I figured, you know, like, and when I didn't really know, like, I'm listening online, and I didn't have, like, all the liner notes, so, but I took some guess, like, I figured a lot of them were my friends on there, but I picked up on Emily Wallace singing with you on, what was it?
Pretty Little Song,
yeah. So I recognize that voice, and she'll be opening the party, you said?
She will be opening the night, and Funky Butt Brass Band will be closing the night, and we're going to sandwich the 11 songs off the record in between those two great acts and do a cover or two, and that'll be the evening. I think it's going to be definitely worth a trip out, and I hope folks come to it, because I'm looking forward to playing it for sure, because this is a really talented group. I just recently had all of them together at Gaslight, and basically just to remind them that they were on a record. I mean, 2 years ago, they came over to, like, either here at Gaslight or to Zeb's house, and they recorded their part on one or two or three songs, and or at Sawhorse, and then they left, and that was it. They didn't hear they weren't there for the mixes. They didn't hear the finished product. And after a year, they probably just forgot about it, to be honest with you. And so as soon as I got the CD in hand, the physical copy, I arranged a night, two nights in a row here on to get them in, which had to be a Monday and Tuesday. Again, they're all working musicians. And I got most of them in, and we ran through all the songs, and I gave them a copy of the CD. I said, hey, thank you. And it's a weird process making a record with folks that, you know, I don't have a band. So it's hired guns and friends, and yeah, it's been great, but I love it this way. I really do enjoy the fact that it's a rotating cast, and this on this record is one hell of a cast. I mean, these guys are all super talented folks.
Definitely. Well, let's talk about Pretty Little Song. You said featuring Emily Wallace. Did you always picture that as a duet?
I did, actually. There was the two girls, or the two songs on the record, Pretty Little Song and Wait and See, that I knew were duets, or I wrote them with the intent to be duets. I wrote Pretty Little Song on my own, but with Kaylin Doolin, who is a songwriter out of Edwardsville. She was there writing another song, and I had just finished up Pretty Little Song. And then we collaborated on writing Wait and See, which I had never done with anybody, and Kaylin did a great job. She's a great singer, songwriter, and she came over and we worked on songs, and it was a new experience. It was just me learning how to write with someone else. And so with her involvement with both of those songs, I think that influenced me wanting it to be like a duet, you know. And so right there, it was somebody I could bounce the ideas off of and see if it works, you know. And so she wrote the third verse on Wait and See, and it's the break, and it's my favorite part of the song. I imagine I probably would have scrapped the song had she not written such good lines.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I can't throw away these great lines, you know. So that song was saved, and I'm glad it was, because now I've learned to love the whole thing. And there was a girl from Carbondale, my last trip to Carbondale. I met all kinds of musicians. Ended up staying the night at a violin player's house. Excuse me. And I met a girl named Janice Esch, who was a singer-songwriter, and a girl named Ginny Johnson. And they both had great voices. They both wrote great songs. And it was one of the best nights of music, sitting around a kitchen table and with a piano in the room, and everybody had a guitar and a banjo and a mandolin, and it was just inspiring. And so I wanted to work with all of these people in the future, so I had always had them in mind. And so I initially had asked them, Janice and Ginny, to come up and sing on those two songs. And Janice is the singer on Wait and See. It worked out, but my direction for Ginny just wasn't right, and I was trying to get more out of her than the song has room for, and they live in Carbondale, and to pay them to come up and go back, when it was done, we couldn't use the work. you know, and the recordings. And it was mainly my fault. It was more bad producing than it was. She's got a great voice, great songwriter and everything. And so after that didn't work out, Zeb was like, well, have you heard Emily Wallace? We should just contact her because she's local. It won't be as big as a hassle to get somebody up from Carbondale. And I was like, sure. I was like, set it up if you can. So I'd never met her, never heard her,
wow.
Nothing. Yeah. I just trust Zeb. And that was the majority of the people on the record were Zeb and Miles' connections, friends from being SIU, you know, students and now teachers, professors.
Right.
And so, yeah, so you get Adam and through that. And I'm friends with, like, Pete Somerville, but, you know, he was a jazz program guitar player, you know, in Edwardsville there, too, at SIUE, where Zeb and Miles are teachers. And so, yeah, so they brought in a lot of people that I had never met. And so that was the other great part about this record was I got to meet a bunch of, like, St. Louis's finest musicians and singers.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it pays to hang with a good caliber of people, I guess.
For sure. Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's crazy that you first hear her singing on the record. That's pretty crazy. But that's what worked out. I mean, it sounds excellent. And it's one of my favorites on there. Got that little more of that country feel to it.
Yes, definitely.
But yeah, it's so where's that lyric content come from? Where do you your writing of it and stuff, like
if you like country music, if you write country music, sooner or later you have to deal with Nashville, I think. You don't have to, but I think it's a common, you know, subject matter and your experience with it. And for me, I've been to Nashville and played songwriter showcases and stuff, but I always leave. You know, like I've never gone there and tried to make it in Nashville because it's never been a big draw for me. I'm not really interested in the Nashville sort of fame mm-hmm. or whatever. And so I wanted to write a song that wasn't so derogatory. That was just more of an understanding of the people who go there and don't make it and kind of don't care. I think how long was it? 7 years ago, there was a lady who came up to Greenville, Illinois to give a lecture or a speech on how to be a songwriter in Nashville. And you paid $20 and you go into above a coffee house and you listen to her because she ran the Bluebird, which is the most famous songwriters showcase in all of Nashville, possibly the United States. Movies have been made about it, songs have been written about it, whatever. And she ran it for years and years and had written hit songs for, you know, big names or whatever. And she came and me and like 10 other songwriters from this area paid her $20 to sit down and listen to how to become a famous songwriter, right? And at the end of it, she had, for me, and I'm not naming names or anything, and she had contradicted herself like 100 times, like, a hit song has the format of verse, chorus, break, chorus. And then she was like, but then you look at, you know, Folsom Prison, and it's instead of A, B, A, B, C, A, it's A, A, A. And that's a number one. That's a hit song there.
Right.
And so it was just that over and over again. Everything she said. The only thing I really took away from it was she said, this is how it works. Every year or every couple months, busloads of people, young and old and whatever, they quit their jobs and they leave their homes from all over the world and they come to Nashville and they get there and they start going to the open mics and the bars and the songwriting things and they group off and they end up living together in houses because you can't afford to anything without roommates down there, and three or four of them will get into a house and two of them will pair off and become a friends, and another two will pair off because they have different styles and different likes, and one of them will sell a song for a commercial or for a TV show or whatever, and then they'll get the door opens and they get pulled through for that one song, and then when they're asked to write the second song and they don't have one, they say, well, I have a friend who does,
right?
And then they open the door and go, that's my friend. So the roommate, one of the other roommates who has a song that's in the style of what they need for the next commercial or whatever, and they pull that person through the door. And then when that person doesn't have a song, it happens again and again and again. And this was her explanation of Nashville and success. And I was like, well, this is the biggest $20 waste of... It wasn't a waste. It was eye-opening, and it was a good lecture, and she had great points. And if you're going to be a songwriter, you got to work at it, and you got to know how to hustle. You got to know how to sell what it is you're creating.
Yeah.
And that's as big a part of it as creating it, as, even though as an artist, we don't want to think that way. So the Pretty Little Song was me writing about those people who got off that bus and did whatever they had to do, had the roommates, wrote the song. Maybe they had a hit, maybe they didn't. And then they just decided, you know, this isn't for me. And they went back home, and then they play music for themselves and their friends and their families at the local, you know, party, barn, whatever they're doing. And it was like, that's okay.
Yeah.
That was a really long explanation.
It does seem like, I think I've heard, like, it's like the fastest growing town. Nashville down there, and like, but like you just like you said, there is great. It might not be for everybody, but it's a great networking opportunity.
Yes.
You know, you're going to meet all kinds of other like-minded people in the same town that all want to. You know, everybody's trying to make it, and they're all trying to do it, and they want to write all the time with the other writers and other players and everything else, and like, so if nothing else, it's a great learning experience, and it's kind of like. I got some friends down there trying to do it, and you know, it's just cool to see them. You know, it might not work out, but they're having fun doing it. So I don't know. It's like I said, I imagine that's just like better than any college or something, like, you know, where
yes.
they can teach you. You're going to learn a lot more just being out there doing it. And
her $20 advice was, if you want to be a songwriter, then you need to move to Nashville,
right?
Or New York or L.A. or wherever there's a call for it, mm-hmm. a need, a supply and demand. So, yeah, so everywhere else is you're kind of spinning your wheels.
Yeah.
There's a ceiling in every other city, whereas if you hit the ceiling in Nashville, you're set.
Yeah.
And one song can do that for you, sort of thing, you know. So it is, I don't have anything against it. It took me years. I wrote a song on my first record when I was in the Flatwheel Band called Song for Satan.
Yeah.
And it's just, it was me being angry at the terrible new country music that was coming out and how it all just turned to crap, and this was back 15 years ago or whatever.
Right.
And so my Song for Satan is about, you know, selling out, or wanting to sell out to go to Nashville and be famous, but it's more about the money and the posters and the sequins, you know, the nudie suits and
yeah.
stuff. And it's just kind of a tongue-in-cheek song. So I guess it's a common concept or idea that I've written about a couple times.
Sure.
Because sitting, you know, being up here and being a St. Louis or Midwest area songwriter, you got to consider it. You know, you hit that ceiling of where you can play, how often you can play, how big your circle is that you can travel in and make a living off of it. It's got to get bigger at some point. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, you can't keep playing the same place over and over again, even though I've tried.
Yeah.
I really have. So, yeah.
I do feel like there is a cool thing happening right now in St. Louis, though, like, where we have a lot of great venues. We have, you know, a bunch of spots that want live music, and it's almost like, you know, between, you know, I know, you're playing, coming up, you're playing, Thanksgiving at Stagger Inn.
Yeah, Thanksgiving night.
The 24th, and then you're playing Imperial Club on the December 16th. So, I mean, you're bouncing around a couple of different spots there.
Mm-hmm.
And even, like, but among St. Louis, like, I feel like you can almost put together a tour around St. Louis, like, because we have all these different little pockets of around the, you know, yeah, you have your downtown, you have your mm-hmm. St. Charles County, you know, that way, you got Carbondale, like you said, or whatever, you know, like all the different, you know, it might be a greater St. Louis area, but it's all kind of centered around the area. But I feel like, you know, there's a lot of cool things happening all over the place. So there is opportunities, but yeah, it's something, like you said, you got to definitely work at it for sure. So
there is, I guess, with what I'm dealing with now, I'm 40 years old and I've been doing it for 20 years, and my friends have hit the age where they're not bar people anymore, mm-hmm. you know, and haven't been for 10 years, you know, kids and work
sure.
and whatever. And to grow, for me, like, it's, you can only do so much. As much as I could write new songs, learn new songs, it's still going to sound like me doing them.
Right.
And so to burn out your audience, you have to have a bigger circle. To be more desirable, to draw more people to the shows, you have to get further out of Dodge. And then, so when you come back, it means something to them. Like, they don't know when you're coming back again. You may take off to Nashville and never come back, so I better go see this show.
Yeah.
You know, whereas if I'm here playing each of these areas, and that's just it,
mm-hmm.
they're not going to come anymore. And then you're just playing to the house, and that's, you're not drawing. And I'm guilty of this. And so it's a tough measurement of how much is too much in one area, and how far do you space it apart? I remember asking Jason Holler of Kentucky Knife Fight, whenever they were together, they were all at SIU college, the band was, Jason Koenig and those guys, and I was asking Jason Holler, the lead singer, I was like, they played, I think, the weekend after school got back in every year, and one other date, I think, at Stagger Inn, spaced 6 months apart, so they played twice a year at Stagger Inn. And when they did, it was packed.
Right.
I mean, you couldn't get in the place. And I asked him, why don't you play here once every two months, once every month, and just, you're killing it. He goes, they wouldn't be here if we did.
Right.
And he was right. Like, you have to, you know, it. I think people want to buy into the fact that you're really living the life and that you're in demand elsewhere as well. Makes you more valuable when you're at home,
mm-hmm.
and as sad as that sounds, or as rough as it is for me, because believe me, I'm lazy. I would love to just travel a small circle and make the same amount of impact.
Yeah,
but I've found that my circle has to grow.
Sure,
you have to space it out. So I don't know if that's I don't think that's for everyone.
Right,
but for me, for sure, like, I've, you know, 20 years at this, I've realized that every time I go out of town, all of a sudden my phone starts blowing up from people I've met, you know, 10, 15 years ago, and they're like, great to see you're doing good, that you're still doing it. But if I post that I'm playing 3 shows a week, 4 shows a week, every week, it goes silent.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as I leave town more than 50 miles, they're like, ooh, he's living that life.
Yeah.
If I don't, yeah, nothing.
Yeah, that's a weird thing. I mean, it's not even just as much for you, but yeah, it's the fan that, or the your friends and stuff too, that it's like a weird, like, mind trick thing. Like, you know, it's kind of like they, I don't know, but yeah, it's kind of, I guess it's kind of one of, goes back to that you don't know what you got till it's gone kind of thing. Like, right. once you feel like you've taken off and you're doing this elsewhere, and then you come back and like, hey, you know, we knew you then or whatever and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
And, yeah. So, but yeah, man. Well, I was thinking also back, I was talking about when we first met, I think the first song that I was introduced to you was Tired Old Suit.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember seeing, I guess, you guys did a Gaslight session or a loft session, whatever.
It was a loft session at the time. Here at Gaslight.
Yeah. And I remember seeing that video and really taken back by that song. And it was, and it also appears on the record and stuff. So now you did the album recording of it. But did you want to maybe play that one today?
Yeah. 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 Sure.
You do have the guitar here. Figured. Get a good chance to do some storytelling with that one.
Well, I've told this story about 100 times. Do you need it?
Do you
want to hear how it came about? Sure. I think it's actually on the guest on the loft session.
I think it's an interesting thing, like just like
where it came from,
right? Just like I feel like that's one of my favorite things about songwriters is the fact that like they can kind of get into that, like where you're writing about the suit and stuff, and you're writing you can find about anything and tell a story about it and stuff. I think that's always a really cool thing. I knew this guy Chase Rice, and he wrote, like, it's not like the best song, but it was an interesting song to me because it was all about, it was an interesting approach to the thing. It was like this story about this hotel room, and like the hotel room's like telling the story, like people come in here every, you know, these, and then like those like
walls could talk.
Yeah,
sort of
right.
Thing.
Yeah, so it was just like an interesting kind of concept, and I feel like that's sort of a kind of how Tired Old Suit is a little bit. Like,
yeah. I'm gonna tune here, sure. So this might be where you edit out like the space. But. Yeah, this cold weather is
sure
brutal. Story came from, I guess, I was in I always like to just say a transitional period where I was crashing on a friend's couch out of necessity, and I had a pile of my stuff in his living room corner, and on top of the pile was the one suit I owned, and the only reason I even owned it is I had received a gift certificate to Men's Warehouse, and I went in and told him I wanted a black coat, black pants, black tie, white shirt. I wanted to wear it to birthdays and weddings and funerals, and you could bury me in it when I was dead. And the clerk said, well, do you want me to throw in the white socks so you can wear it as a Blues Brothers costume for Halloween? I said, absolutely. And so he sold me the suit. And one morning I woke up on my friend's couch, and I looked over at that pile of stuff, all that I owned, and saw the suit, and I thought, what if I wore that every day for the rest of my life? And then I grabbed a pen and paper and my guitar, and I wrote down this song. So.
There ain't much that's good left on this tired old suit. And I've grown accustomed to the holes in my shoes. And I remember how it felt when I bought it brand new. Now there ain't much that's good left on this tired old suit. There's these holes in my pockets where my money falls through. And it's what I've been saving to give back to you. I could've sworn there was more, well, I guess it fell through. All the holes in the pockets of this tired old suit. Cuffs are both frayed from rolling up sleeves. Lights in the alley and work week after week. Worn in the knees from the prayers that I keep, leaving unanswered before I fall asleep. Will the elbows worn thin from the bars where I lean? There's a tear I repaired from a fall in the streets. And all the places and people that I've run into, and the stitches I'd put in this tired old suit. There's lipstick on the collar and these little blood stains. A constant reminder of love and of pain. And I've heard poets tell how they're wanting the same. When I look at this suit, only the one still remains. Feet have grown used to these holes in my shoes. Walking round aimless and from running from fools. Puddles and those rocks I've removed. Oh, the distance I've traveled in the soles of these shoes. From birthdays to funerals, well, I've worn this so. I remember how it felt when I
bought it brand new. They say the clothes make the man, I say the man makes the suit. Well, the longer you wear it, the more that it looks like you. From birthdays to funerals and this tired old suit.
Thought of one of my favorite lines was from that Walk the Line movie, the Johnny Cash.
Oh yeah.
When he gets all dressed up and she's like, "You look like you're going to a funeral," and maybe I am. One of my favorites, man.
Yeah.
That's what I thought of when the all black and all that stuff. But yeah, man, great song. And like I said, appears on bottles, available now. Grab your copy. Follow Dana online. He said you can, if you message him, you can send you one if you want a hard copy. And I do recommend it. Like I said, it's a beautiful piece. And I'm just a fan of having a tangible thing. You know, I love having either if it's a CD or a record or whatever. I love owning physical copies. I'm not having really kind of, I might listen to it on my phone or iPod or whatever, but I'd love having the physical copy at home and or in the car and whatever it is. So.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, so I'm glad you did that. A lot of people are kind of getting away from having physical copies. So,
yeah, it's almost a novelty anymore. It's almost like a business card more than it's the means of distributing the music, which I understand, you know. And half of me is like, well, no waste, you know, download everything, and then you don't have to cut down a tree and make plastic.
But yeah,
I understand the folks wanting to hold it in their hand, read the liner notes. I mean, I grew up doing the same thing,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah, it's kind of a lost thing now. But I was kind of talking. I mentioned about some of the kind of jazzier sounds on the record too. There was a one that I stood out to me called "Love Struck Fools." Kind of got a little more of that kind of vibe to it, some cool horns on there too and stuff. Just a really great song.
Thank you.
I don't know. I was speaking of Blues Brothers too. You mentioned. I also thought of. I kind of was waiting for that kind of the Minnie the Moocher kind of vibe to it.
Yeah,
you know, it was like
that,
I was waiting for the chorus kicking the hidey hidey
hidey. A little scat going on. Yeah,
but I felt really good, and I gotta say, really was. I love that. Just like again, the variety. Just that, you know, you never knew what was coming next. So,
for me, I grew up here in 88.1. Is after I found Uncle Tupelo, which my older brother turned me on to in high school, I think I was a sophomore, the radio just wasn't the same for me. And pop tunes and the songs that I'd grown up with, a million times hearing the same song every hour from Keishi to, you know, the Clue 103. And I knew every word to every one of those songs by the time I was 12 years old,
right.
You know, from Aretha Franklin to the Beatles to, you know, Rodney James Dio and Black Sabbath. So to find out that there was local music, new music, music with a totally different sound, I was blown away. And so when I heard Tupelo, I was like, where can I get more of this? And then sooner or later, being in St. Louis, you're going to find 88.1. And for me, once I found it, especially through high school, college, I never took it off my radio. Like, my radio dial never moved after that, because it's never the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sure, for 2 hours or whatever, you're going to get one style, but it's going to be every time you hear that show, it's not going to be the show you heard last week,
right?
You know, and then after that 2 hours is over, you're going to get 2 hours of totally other, you know, unique sounds from Music from the Hills or Grateful Dead with Dre or Blues in the Alley or whatever, like Fishing with Dynamite with Fred Friction was my favorite show, of course, at the time. And and it was like, it was like you had a friend that was giving you, slipping you, you know, underground singles.
Right.
And you're in your car everywhere, you know. And so that diversity of music, that fact that it bounced from jazz to folk to blues to rock and roll to only strictly female singer-songwriters to music from Croatia and Latin music and jazz and all of it. And I was just like, this is it. This is what I like about music is that, and I like finding new things. And so I wanted to really make a record that represented how I grew up listening to music, which has been a vast, you know, influence from all over the world of you know, artists. And so I hope I did that. The other influence that this record has for me anyway is one of my favorite records of all time is Tom Waits' Rain Dogs. And from what I've read about it, I think it was like either his sixth or his eighth record. Either way, it was the record where his manager was like, who do you want to play guitar? Who do you want to play drums? We can get them now because you're big enough. And he was like, I want Keith Richards. You know, I'm sure he said it way cooler than I just did because he's Tom Waits, but right. He wanted to work with Keith Richards.
Yeah.
And so he did. He got to. And if I, when I hear that record, I think, well, this is that moment where he was like, he had all the toys at his disposal. He could have done whatever he wanted. So he did a little bit of everything. I mean, that record is all over the place with sounds and styles and, you know, it's just a massive transition from one song to the next. And I love it. And it was hard for me to understand when I first listened to it. I think the first time I got it, I was in high school. I was at a doctor's office, and I was looking at a Rolling Stone. And in the back of Rolling Stone, I don't know if they still have it. I haven't looked at a Rolling Stone in years. But there used to be a little, like, 4x4 square that says, here's a record that you missed that you probably shouldn't have.
Yeah.
And then explains why. And then this time, it was Tom Waits' Rain Dogs. So I went to Vintage Vinyl in Grand City, and I bought the CD. And I spent $15 on it. I got it home, and I put it in the headphones. And my mom was like, we got 2 hours before dinner. I went to my room, and I plugged it in. And the first time I listened to it, I was like, what is this? I wasted $15. This is awful. Like, I don't understand it. It doesn't make sense. And then I was like, no, I trust Rolling Stone. No, I know Tom Waits is a good writer. I just don't know why, because I'm too young.
Yeah.
You know? And it was other people's opinions. And so I put it on replay, and I laid there, and forced myself to listen to it, and after it got through, halfway through, all of a sudden I started to see what it was he was singing about. I started to see German in a factory with the owner with a tumor as big as an egg on his neck, and then I saw a Shanghai sailor in Singapore, and then I saw the midnight train in New York, and then I saw the world while I was laying there in my bed listening through Tom Waits' words, and it all just was like this beautiful movie, and it exposed me to so much of what I've never seen, but I felt like I had. The best way I can describe it as far as what I saw is when I first saw Pirates of the Caribbean, which of course Keith Richards plays Johnny Depp's pirate dad in it,
yeah.
I took my mom, and she goes, when Keith Richards comes on the screen for the first time, she goes, where did they find these ugly actors? These are the ugliest actors I've ever seen. I go, Mom, that's Keith Richards. She goes, that explains it. But what you see in that, the way they look, the way they're dressed, the way the scenery behind them, the sets, that's what I saw the first time I heard Rain Dogs, you know, on certain songs, you know. And it was that vivid and colorful and beautiful. And so this was my, whenever I got to work with Zeb and Miles, they opened the door to the toy, you know, proverbial toy chest for me to be able to work with who I want and try to make the sounds that I've always wanted for some of these songs. So if you've been a fan in the past and you see that most of these songs are on older records, which some of them are, and there are some that aren't, there's a reason for that. I finally got the chance to make them the way I've always heard them in my head and never had the ability or tools or people at my disposal or as friends to help me do that. So this is my Rain Dogs, like for me, the way it felt was I finally had reached a level of success where I could finish a song the way I wanted to. So Love Struck Fools, we went totally Jungle Book, jazz, King Louis scene. Yeah. Like, I wanted to finish it as a jazz song, as a, you know, and the lyrics were written by Jason Holler. He wrote the lyrics to that song and The Choir in the Sky, which is the Paul Simon Graceland tune. And he told me, you can't move any words, you can't change any words, don't touch any words, and just write the music around it. And it was complicated. I've never done anything like that before, and I wasn't sure, and it was in a weird pattern. And he was like, can't move it, don't change it. And I tried, and he was like, nope, put it back. And so I'm proud of what came out of it. Like, it was a true collaboration with Jason, and it was a true collaboration and trust to get it to sound that big jazz sound with Aaron and Adam and Zeb and Miles and Pops Jackson. Excuse me. And, yeah, so...
Yeah, man. I think that's a beautiful thing that you talked about, because that's a lot of how I feel when I listen to music. Like, I love the, when I, especially with singer-songwriters, and it's probably why I connect to them as much as I do, but, like, the fact that they're telling that story, and in your mind, you're painting this picture along with them, you know, and you can, you're right there in your room, but you visited the world, you know, and that's right. A beautiful thing. I love the way music can take you on that journey and stuff, and, so, but also the fun thing you said, talking about being Tom Waits and stuff, like, when I listen to the record, not that I always, like, I compare, but I feel like sometimes I can pick out influences before you even say, and that was one that came to mind, was Tom Waits, and, like, and I think that's a cool thing, too, like, the way that your voice can kind of lend to something like that, to where you almost kind of get that Tom Waits kind of vibe, too, but then you're, you know, then it takes on a totally different tone to, you know, you're able to manipulate your voice a lot to lend to different tracks or whatever the case may be. So I think that's a cool thing to offering a lot of variety out of your voice and stuff. It's not, and so
thanks. Yeah, that's a huge compliment.
Yeah.
Anytime anyone uses a reference, and it's just flattering, you know. I because they're my heroes too, you know, like, I'm trying to be better at write, like, if I want to write a song like Tom Waits, I want it to be convincing. I want people to know that's where my influences come from. Otherwise, I probably failed.
Yeah.
And I always think of, like, the Ramones, right? I always thought that they wanted to be Elvis Presley, but they were so bad at it that they became the Ramones. And they were really good at being the Ramones,
yeah.
But they were really terrible at being Elvis Presley, and that's what makes them such great Ramones. So I have no qualms about, like, I don't try to hide my influences. I definitely put them out there on my sleeve and out front and say, here's the people that influenced me, that I love, that I respect. I mean, Paul Simon's Graceland. We ended up somewhere in the Caribbean, I think. But the people that, you know, we were going for, you know, Ladysmith Black Mambazo, and we ended up on a cruise ship, and, you know, which is fine, because then it's like the Ramones not being very good Elvises. They're still really good Ramones, you know what I mean? And that's what I've learned to accept. Had I been younger and full of more pride, I guess, you know, you'd be like, oh, no. That was the hardest song for me to put on the record, because it was the furthest away from anything I've ever done, because it was happy.
Yeah.
And it was like, and it was sounded like a carrot, you know, it has that Afro-Cuban beat to it, and I'm like, this is a stretch, Dana. So as much as I like to be able to try to traverse all possible genres and boundaries and be good at it, I know where my limitations are, I think.
Yeah.
And I get to push them with this record, and so it was fun. It's been fun.
Yeah, man. Very cool. You want to play one more for us live?
Sure. You got a request. I'm easy.
Like, yeah. Well, how about One Good Hand?
Okay. Perfect, because I think I have this thing tuned to where it'll be in tune with the capo. Nice. In the same spot.
This one, I thought, like, on the record, like, we were talking about some of the slide work and stuff. There's it features a lot of slide, and I love that country twangy pedal steel stuff. That's
John Mondin played just straight up slide on a Stratocaster on this one.
Okay.
So yeah, this one is just slide guitar. Nice. The old fashioned way, bottleneck.
It sounded real good though.
Here's that part where you edit me out again. That wasn't nearly as bad as I thought it would be. This is a good old... I seem to have the same... A lot of the reoccurring themes when I write. And this one is about a gambler who's a cheat card shark, whatever. And he's traveling some dirt road backwoods, you know, town, comes across a roadhouse, gets into a backroom game, and it's with the wrong people. And they catch him cheating, and so they break his hand with a mallet, with a hammer, and tell him he's never going to hold a crooked card in his hand ever again. And he pulls a blade from his boot, because every good gambler should have a straight razor in their boot, I think. And he cuts his way out of there and jumps in his car and drives off as far as he can till the car gives up. And then he can't hold the pistol that he has in the glove box anymore because his hand's already been broken. His good hand, his card hand, has been broken. It's also his shooting hand. And the whole time, though, he's thinking about his brother. And his brother's the straight-laced one, the good one, the you know, stayed-at-home, built a family. And he's thinking about what he's going to think about. This is it. This is the end. And he's going to be embarrassed and, you know, tell him I love him, basically, is all that runs through his head in his last act. And so, yeah, maybe there's some underlying, you know, struggles I've had with JB in the past, I would say, as far as older brother living up to expectations. So that's what this one's about. It comes a little bit from, you know, that family aspect, and mainly it's just I think it's a neat story. Sometimes that, you talked about seeing movies when you hear, that's how I hear music too. And I put if it's a song that hits me, immediately there's a movie that plays along in front of my eyes or whatever in the back of my head, and typically it stays. Like, it doesn't change much. If I hear a song, it's like, that's the movie that goes along with it. So this one, I always watch this little movie in my head of this card shark, and it's called One Good Hand.
Stripped and the rack top's bloody. Gonna use a little spit and chat. Called my brother, but he won't answer. Always said I'd never end up worth that time. Maybe it was that girl from Philly. Looked at her the way she looked at me. Maybe it's always been about our father. Meetings that it took just to come for me. Won't stay long in it, all night diner's gone. My cheek don't need no pair. Last man standing, hardly the winner. Bones won't heal in my one good hand. All night game in a rigged back table. Never saw it coming till it was all gone. All I had, little there was. Never trust your luck, you can cover that loan. My wrist and I swung that hammer. Said I'd never hold another crooked card in my hand. Pulled my blade when they weren't looking. Cut my way out of the lion's den. Won't stay long in it all night down. It's gone my cheek, don't need no pair. Last man standing, I'll leave the winner. Bones won't heal in my wound. Couldn't hold the pistol in my one good hand. Laid me down, they called it even. Someone tell my brother hope he understands.
Yeah, man.
Thanks.
Sounded great.
Nice.
That is that something you're talking about, kind of that painting that picture, the movie and everything go with it. Mm-hmm. Is that something you want to put together, music videos or anything for that, or any of the songs on this record? Is that something you think about?
I'm always open to working with creative people. I think that the point for me is to make enough money to keep creating more stuff, you know, because it's meditation. It's you know, it keeps me sane, you know, and it's therapy, it's meditation, it's whatever. It's what I do, you know, that makes me happy. So working with other people is key for me to keep it changing, to keep growing. You know, you have to shake things up. That's the other part about me wanting to, you know, get further and further away from St. Louis is every time I do, I always have a blast.
Right.
But I'm really easy at being comfortable too. Like, it's really easy for me to just stay home and play piano all day.
Yeah.
Like, I'm pretty much good at doing anything, or, you know, being lazy or whatever. I kind of have to force myself. So anytime an opportunity comes up, music videos or collaborations or you know, emceeing gigs like that I would never do, like benefits and stuff, like, hey, can you, you're comfortable with the microphone in your hand, would you mind coming and like emceeing this? That's happened to me, and I like that stuff. I like getting out there and doing new things and working with new people. So yeah, I've met a few videographers and stuff that are interested. Again, creative people tend not to be very organized too, so a lot of it's barroom talk and it disappears. If somebody's serious and wants to do something, I would be more than happy to work with them. And that's how I just keep that door open, I think. I try to.
Sure. I mean, I just think it'd be cool to bring those stories to life, you know, bring it.
It would be amazing. Yeah. I would love to be a part of that project. I was a visual artist at first. Whenever I was in high school and college, I was a painter and sculptor and did all that stuff. So to work with somebody who's spent the last 20 years actually improving their trade, their craft or whatever, and try to combine it with what I've been working on, that would be awesome.
Yeah,
I would love to see it.
Nice. Well, maybe we can get there.
Yeah. Maybe this podcast will shake the tree and get knock somebody loose that's interested in looking
cool.
for a project.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. But again, the big one, we want you to come out to see the full effect February 2nd off Broadway. Again, that's Emily Wallace will be there opening the show. Then you got Dana with a full band. We're going to have most of the players from the record. And then Funky Butt's going to finish the night out.
Yeah, party us out. That's the plan, is to end on a high fun note with them.
Those guys definitely know how to party.
They do.
A lot of fun. So, but we do have a couple other dates. Check the website. Is it Dana Michael Anderson? Is that
Facebook? Yeah, Dana Michael Anderson. There's the band page and my personal page, and I just use the personal page as a band page. So I really have two: Dana Michael Anderson, YouTube, and Facebook. I don't do much with the Twitter. I don't do anything actually with the Twitter.
Yeah,
I probably will in the future, but not right now. So mainly Facebook, YouTube, and. Yeah, that's it.
And I don't know. Twitter's kind of dead to me. Like, it's kind of like I share the show on there, but like it just doesn't seem like there's much activity there. So
yeah,
some people are really good at it. It's never been for me. But
I'm not very tech savvy myself.
Yeah.
So,
well, this has been awesome. I appreciate you taking time out to hang and share some stories of this record. And again, everybody, pick up a copy of Bottles today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, man.
I appreciate it.
I'll see you soon.
All right.
Rock Paper Podcast.
Rock Paper Podcast.
Rock Paper Podcast.
Well, yeah, that was it.